This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to the October edition of Landmark Women. My name is Monica Lindemann, Head of Development, and I'm very pleased to see you all here today. And it is my very great pleasure to introduce this month's very special speaker. So Dr. Sue Packer is our guest today. Dr. Packer has dedicated decades to improve the lives of children who have been abused or neglected. She's been a paediatrician since 1972 and has worked in the ACT since moving here in 1980. She has a long list of voluntary roles, all dedicated to the improvement of the lives of children, including serving on the boards of the National Association for Prevention of Child Abuse, KidSafe and the Defence for Children International. Dr. Packer was made a member of the Order of Australia in 1999 for services to child welfare, paediatrics and the public. She was named Canberra Citizen of the Year just last year in recognition of her personal efforts and significant contributions to the ACT community, particularly as an advocate for the safety and well-being of children. Dr. Packer is also the chair of the ACT Government's Mr. Fluffy Reference Group, leading a group of 9 members to help inform government policy regarding the future of more than 1,000 Canberra homeowners affected by the Mr. Fluffy asbestos insulation. In addition to all of this, Dr. Packer is also a mother of 3. Please welcome Dr. Packer to the stage.
Good morning, it's lovely to see you all, and this is the moment when you suddenly get scared and think, what was I going to talk about anyway? I guess the main thing is, firstly, I've been doing things for a very long time. But I thought I'd start off with one of my favourite posters. Now, this is one of a series of posters painted especially for NAPCAN, that's National Association for Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect, by an Aboriginal artist, Tex Scuthorpe, who took a series of traditional Aboriginal stories with a child protection meaning and painted and donated them to NAPCAN. This is sort of the sentinel one, which says children are sacred. The child, which is very obvious, is the little pink sacred person in the middle with the 2 initiated parents. The parents are supported in looking after their child and bringing their child up by all the people in their community. And their community is part of a bigger lot of support through the surrounding communities. So there are many layers of people with a responsibility for this child. If anything happens to harm this child, the response is not to look for someone to blame, but for the whole community to jointly bear the blame for not looking after the child. I think this is very important in several ways. Firstly, because we're very much a blaming society, and secondly, because we so often look at the negative picture of Aborigines, what has happened to them after 200-plus years of colonisation and total destruction of their previous living structure. I think it's a harsh lesson for us on what can happen when all the basic rules and expectations for your civilization are overwhelmed by something else. And I like the picture, so I thought I'd leave that up there while I was talking to remind me. I think another component of that, it's the things you discover in retrospect, which are probably very important in your life, is my very dearly beloved uncle was a professor of anthropology here at ANU, Professor Stanner, who was really instrumental in developing the AHC Institute across the road, which is one of my favourite places. Particularly, there's the Stanner Reading Room there, which to me is a very special room. But more than that, as a small growing up child at a time when Australia really was in the height of White Australia policy and very prejudiced against everybody else, he was a person whose everyday living was to tell me of the wonderful, complex culture of Australian Aborigines. So that was what I grew up with. I have never really forgiven him. My sister and I wanted to go with him when he went on one of his excursions to the Northern Territory, and we helped pack his truck and load all these funny things like tinned butter. And we really, really wanted to go with him, and he absolutely refused to take us. Just imagine having two small girls going across Northern Territory. But that's... But his way of dealing with it for us is to say, I can hear what had happened. You'd get up there and you'd start complaining, oh, Uncle Bill, there are flies in my milk. And he'd say, they're not flies, they're tadpoles, and it's not milk, it's muddy water, and drink it. So that was really his experience of the Northern Territory. But it also, I think, showed the fortunateness of that aspect of my childhood in having that sort of experience. So I then thought, what sort of message would I like to leave you people with at the end? And I guess it does come down to having a fresh look at children. Australia as a country is not great in its record for loving children. I think we love our own children intensely most of the time. But as a community, children are seen more as a nuisance, a threat, an expensive time consumer, an expensive consumer of resources. They're not terribly well regarded. So if people start thinking again about children, their abilities, the environment we're providing for them to grow up, which is a big worry for me, and their needs, and perhaps in the course of this, revisit the inner child within us all. Because I think one of the most interesting things about our attitude to children is somehow we forget as adults that we were children. I mean, I'm not a terribly religious person, but I do go back to quoting the Bible when they said, and when I became a man, I put away childish things. And I think this is one of the saddest losses of knowledge in our civilization, because we learn so much as children about people and about people's responses. And you keep getting arrested in the most unlikely places. I was reading a rather horrible and bloodthirsty whodunit about a child who was supposed to have murdered someone and was on the run. And one of the things said by this child, or thought by this child, was that every adult has been a child, but they've forgotten how to think as a child. No child has been an adult, but they rapidly learn how adults think and how to respond to them. And I think, yeah, it's just is interesting to think about, and I guess I've reflected on this a lot in the course of my work with abused and neglected children. Now, these are children who can't rely on caring adults to watch out for things and watch out for them. And the capacity of these children to continually check their environment and have to make their own decisions and make their own judgments overwhelms me at times. It distresses me enormously at times, and obviously many of these children make wrong judgments and wrong decisions. So on the basis of all this, the essence of my whole message would be to delight in children, and not only delight in them, but learn ways of showing your delight. And it doesn't mean that everything children do is wonderful, and they know it's not wonderful, and they want to be told it's not wonderful. But at times when you are enjoying being with a child, I think it is wonderful to be able to sit back and really enjoy that. Because my other thought, after all these years of work, so much of what happens with children, we're doing to children and doing for children. Now, as a doctor, I do a moderate amount of doing too. This involves things like medical procedures and investigations, immunisation. Children don't have any choice in this. The family don't have a lot of choice. And you're directly doing things to children. Most of what we do in the everyday world is doing for children. And when we love our children and we want the best for them, we conscientiously provide the best food, the best accommodation, the best clothing, toys, whatever else. But at times we don't actually sit back and think, what contribution can the child make to this? Are we making the right choices? It is so much more delightful and enjoyable when you do things with a child. And it can be anything from out in the garden with the child,
cooking. Cooking has to be done when you're not under pressure. There's nothing worse than a chaotic cooking session with an enthusiastic young child. But at the same time, if you leave it till you know the floor needs washing anyway and let them go to it, that can be great fun. So the doing with children is something I think in our time-poor society we don't do nearly enough. And we tend to do it a lot on our own terms. You can do this with me. We don't sort of sit back and look at the possibilities of what the child can initiate to do with them. Yet, in the middle of all this, by the time they're in their late teens, we expect them to be pretty well responsible adults. Yet with very, very little opportunity to learn the skills they're going to need to be a responsible adult.
So children, particularly in our society when we have this enforced long period of childhood with children being financially dependent on their adults and their parents and other people, and this seems so often now to extend into the 20s and 30s and even beyond that, and we're not quite sure how to deal with it, and somewhere along the line in the middle of all this, children are supposed to develop into individual and responsible adults. And I think it is increasingly difficult for this to happen. I mean, in a way, in the past, when you knew you were out of the house when you finished school, or else you had to stay at home till you turned 21, got the key of the door, got married, whatever else, and you were out of the house, it mightn't have been ideal, but there were very, very clear expectations. Now children are somehow, as adolescents, supposed to pick up the right messages, but in a world where our own messages to them are very, very confused. So that I think the passage to adulthood for a lot of young people is much more difficult than it used to be. You don't particularly like having to be dependent until you're very much older. I seem to be getting more and more depressed about these things. In any case, the last sentence I've written down about this is one that arrested me many years ago when I think it was... It was one of the big nature studies before David Attenborough, was The Ascent of Man or Origin of Species, or one of those ones. But a standout comment there was, when a species loses its capacity to rear its young, the species perishes. And again, this probably comes more from working in medicine. Most young families taking a baby home from hospital these days has had nothing to do with babies before the baby for whom they have total responsibility is placed in their hands. And on top of that, these days, you're usually home by day two. And I think there are community supports, but I think back to when I was supposed to know all about babies, I was a paediatrician when I had my children, and I found it extraordinarily challenging, and the babies didn't do what the book said they should do. And the help that came in was not always helpful. In fact, it was often felt to be very critical. And this is a very, very hard world in which to bring up a baby. And now we've got young people saying, but we don't intend to change our life for the child. The child has different ideas, I think. But again, we're expecting these people to do these things. Huge emphasis on material stuff that you need for a child. An expectation that your child will have, a considerable time in childcare. Whether it's not really thought that, hang on, I better get my drink of water. Many mothers in particular who have been delighting in staying home with their baby, but made to feel guilty and selfish for depriving their baby of a socialising experience. This at a time when we're learning more and more in an almost terrifying way about the way the brain develops in the first year of life. I find this extremely exciting. But it is worrying. I went to a lecture on a conference on children and trauma only a couple of months ago with some very eminent researchers from America, and the evidence is all pointing to the fact that the right hemisphere of the brain, the side that's to do more with the feelings, emotions, perceptions, is the predominant hemisphere to develop in the first year of life. And it's the subtle interactions. It's both with a small number of known caregivers which give the best development to the right hemisphere. And this is the combination of the wonderful, zingy, connecting moments you occasionally get with your child and the calm, reflective times you spend with your child. My concern is that even in the most conscientious and well-run childcare, you don't get many of those moments. You've got people who care very much, who provide good things, but they don't have the overwhelming emotional investment in that child that a parent has. And in the long term, is this going to be significant? If you look at the child day to day, we don't think so. But do we know so? And particularly when we've got a world where we're getting increasing incidents of mental health problems, is this a contributor? And we don't know. So to an extent, the way we're bringing up our children now is a social experiment. And I think most of us are not terribly interested. The only driver for childcare has nothing to do with child's development. It's to get the women back into the workforce. And it's to provide something for the children which is good enough for the families to accept. It is not the best we can provide as an alternative. And I'll get onto my next hobby horse after that, which is education, which is very much the same. In this country, we provide what is good enough to get us over the line on the few measures we make of how well children are educated. And I include in this very much NAPLAN, which is more a measure of the tools than the education. It's obviously critical that children learn to read, and we've done very badly in some places with children learning to read, and particularly for the children that I have so much to do with who don't get the help they need at home. But all NAPLAN is really doing is, in a way that is more in keeping with the way I was tested at school a very, very, you know, more than half a century ago, is actually measuring the end product that these children can do mathematical processes, can read, have some ability to comprehend. And now we want to add a little bit more grammar and punctuation as well. But in terms of an education which encourages children to think, to question, to experiment, to explore, we aren't doing terribly well in Australia. And the better measure is probably the OECD measure of education. One of the lowest scoring countries in that is America. The highest scoring one, always makes us very frustrated, is usually Finland and Norway and Sweden and the Scandinavian countries. And if we're looking at what is provided in both those countries, in the countries that are doing the best, we have a uniform, high-standard education. People who train as teachers have the highest school-leaving scores, are highly regarded and are highly paid because of their critical task teaching children to learn. We always have and we always will have some wonderful, inspired and dedicated teachers here. This is despite the fact that entry level for education in this country is the lowest acceptable tertiary entrance scores. And many people get into there knowing this is their best opportunity for an university education. For some people, as I said, they do develop into wonderful teachers. But despite the dedicated efforts of many people also within the education facilities, many people end up in teaching in a very much a default way and are quite overwhelmed and bewildered by the tasks in front of them. And again, I see the worst side of this because I go into school advocating for abused and neglected children who have not learnt to interact with other people, who have not learnt to communicate appropriately, who are in many cases something close to nightmares in school, but the schools are supposed to accommodate them. And again, the public system has very little choice. the private system can exclude children like this, but within the public system I'm repeatedly being told we will only have this child in school if they are medicated. And the medication doesn't do a great deal. And again, nobody asks the children how they feel on medication. The parents, the doctors and the teachers will say he behaves better. But many of these children, if you ask, have quite significant confusion and bewilderment on medication. It mightn't make them feel great. And are there other ways we can do it better? Do we actually look at why these children don't settle in, at what other things might help? I mean, a beginning one, which is glaringly obvious, is that the amount of physical activity in school these days is way, way down. I don't mean formal organised sport, but sort of running the fidgets out of children. And if you've come from living in an apartment, and increasingly children are living in apartments, to school where you're supposed to sit down and concentrate, I think most children are a whole heap better off if the fidgets are run out of them a couple of times a day. And if this can be done as well with some more exciting dancing, rhythmic activities, whatever else happens to really entice a group of children, I think it would be so much better. But so much of what we do with children, again, is doing for and doing to and not doing with. I've had a recent grumble about my concerns about our new and expensive and in many ways wonderful women and children's hospital we've built here in the ACT. My concern is that any child going into that building would be hard-pressed to know that it's a building for children. It's tricky because it's a hospital for women and children, and many women coming in would not be overly impressed or overly encouraged by having a very obvious children's hospital. But even if you move away from the front entrance to the paediatric part of the hospital, it is more like a modern minimalist hotel than a children's hospital. And I think we don't anticipate the amount of consultation we had for that hospital was overwhelming. Yet even with all of this, which didn't include a consulting children because we don't know how to do it, we've in many ways still got it wrong. So I think we have many challenges and many lessons if we are to better look after children. But the way it has ended up now, if you're a child in for a short time feeling ill, with a committed family with the facilities to stay with you, it's probably not bad at all. You're in a single room with your mum or dad. You're looked after all the time and you go home and you're looked after. If you have parents who are exhausted, bewildered, fed up, being shut in a room with them is not a great thing, or you might be shut in a room without them. And that's not a great thing either. If you're parents who want a lot of help, it can be very much harder to access help from a single room than from having a number of people in a room together. We're communal animals. We're not animals that live in little individual cells, but that's the way we've ended up. If you're a mum who's really struggling, who needs more help, it's much easier to get that in the open ward. But we're so scared of germs these days that the germs have won. It does sound negative, doesn't it? But it's not. I mean, in the middle of it all, you've got these amazing kids. And if you sit back and actually look at each child individually, as you tend to do with your own children and grandchildren, you can delight in them enormously. And you are overwhelmed by their talents. And one of their talents is for new electronic equipment. But are we so surprised? Again, if you look around shopping centres, you look when you're out, you've got a child in one hand and the mother's got the device in the other hand. And most of the attention is to the device, not the child. I hear some lovely chatting and look around to see what's happening. And it's the machine that's being talked to, not the child. Is it surprising the child will then pick up anything of that shape, hold it to its mouth, and from the very earliest months try to imitate a mobile phone? Then, to keep them quiet, then they rapidly learn much quicker than old people how to use all the buttons on the phone. That delights everybody. So come and see what he can do with the phone. Come and see. But then a few years later when you can't get them off the thing, it's the child's fault. So I think it's just something we need to think through again. It's a fact of life. We all use them. We all love them. But you sit in a doctor's waiting room now. You don't have murder and mayhem. You've got a row of little kids playing with buttons. They're very well behaved. But it's something totally different. And the children accommodate these things much, much faster than we do. They get a lot of delight out of them, and I think they can be used very beneficially. But they're a significant change, and they are a worry. One of the best things I've done in my sort of occasional bit of retirement is start to build a small children's garden in the front of my house, because in front of the yard, because it's quite close to a childcare centre, early childhood school, and one of the delightful teachers there periodically brings these four-year-olds up to check on my garden, and they send me letters telling me what maybe I ought to do instead. Are the paths going to lead anywhere interesting? Do you think you'll keep chooks in the barn? And things like that. But it is fascinating to see children using an outdoor space and having ideas and thinking through things and working out what's going to happen. But how many opportunities do they have? Just imagine if your parents with a child, several children living in an apartment. You've got a small outdoor balcony, perhaps. This for children is terrifying, and that's something I brought up with builders, and they told me it's not an issue. Even if you've got very safe heights and structures, what enterprising child is not going to push something over to the side and climb up? And children do fall off balconies. So the use children can make of balconies unsupervised is very, very limited. So the alternative is to take them outside to play. You can't leave little children outside playing without a grown-up watching them. So their capacity for prolonged, relaxed, experimental, diving in and out of things play diminishes to almost zero. Very few parents can put up with more than half an hour in a playground. They then think of some way to take the child home. Yet this is happening all the time. I first thought of this a long time ago when I was working in London, and I had a cousin, an Australian cousin over there. I never saw her in Australia, but I saw her quite a bit in London, and she was... Her husband had a very good job, and she was in a very nice flat in a very nice part of London, and her nearest green area to play happened to be Kensington Gardens. But that was the only place these children could play. I mean, it sounds lovely in a way, but you would take these lively little boys out, play around Kensington Gardens for a while, negotiate the traffic, come home to the mess and the chaos and the everything else, and knowing that the husband was bringing significant people home for dinner. It's not a good way for children to grow up, and it's becoming the norm. And if we pride ourselves as Australians as these enterprising, high-initiative, outdoor, energetic people, this is not the generation of children we're bringing up. We're bringing up a very different generation of children. We are quite relieved that they like their computer games and things, though we feel a bit guilty because they sit and eat and get fat then, and then we've got another worry. But what are we doing about it in a big way? I mean, one of the things I really celebrate now is this last weekend was the opening of the Boundless Playground. This is a wonderful idea and a wonderful initiative, and it's the sort of thing that makes me love being in Canberra. To build a playground. Is this thing mostly working, or am I mostly talking away from it? That's right. Yeah. But they built this wonderful playground for children of all abilities and disabilities to be able to participate fully. And I'm about to go and try it out with a group of people, I hope. But, I mean, things like that for children, with the community behind doing something to give children a good, a challenging, a different time. The plan with this is to give children the opportunity to have to think of other ways to do things. And that's what so often is missing now. You've got prefabricated, brightly coloured, uni-purpose toys. Even more so, they're often strongly promoted with the film or whatever other production to have the right characters, the right games and the everything else. Yet we want imaginative children, so what are we going to do about it? So what are the consequences? This is more from my work of not seeing children. And we can immediately think that if a child is not seen, we don't know if they're hurting, we don't know what's happening to them. I mean, small bits of not seeing, as I was just saying, I think are quite good. I think it was one of the delights of my childhood in the Blue Mountains was growing up. Next stop after our fence was a gully, and provided we were within cooey, literally, we played in the gully. We did all manner of things we shouldn't have done. We had wonderful times sorting them out and working out how to get out of the scrapes we got into. We had a safe enough and well-known enough neighbourhood that many people scolded me and threatened to tell my mother about the things I was doing. But we had, but children just don't have these opportunities to do wonderful things. In fact, thinking of it, it was a really wonderful community. I think 1 week we had rain like we've had this week. I and my mates from all the next houses were out in the rain. We had an unmade road with an unmade gutter. And our game for that day was to dam up this gutter till the water went to the middle of the road. It was a dead end street. It was wonderful. It kept us busy for hours. I remember lying flat on my tummy on the wet road with my arm down to the bottom of the dam and it didn't quite reach it. One of the men walking home came past it. His comment was, "Well, you work harder than the council, don't you?" The more I think of it now, the more I think, what a wonderful comment. I think I was picked up by the scruff of the neck at the door and dropped in the bath, and that was the end of the game. And presumably some grown-ups overnight removed our huge hazard from the middle of the road, and we'd forgotten we'd played our game to its completion, and that was fine. But how many opportunities do kids in Canberra have for that sort of play-to-the-limit sort of play? I saw a very good survey in a Western Australian childcare where they tried to find out from the children. They asked one little boy why he didn't play with the blocks. He said, "I just start to build something interesting and you make me pack them away." And this preschool, this childcare centre started saying, right, each child can play with their toys till they're finished. They have a responsibility to put them away when they're finished, but they can play all day. Similarly with meals. The meal would be delivered. If you're in the middle of a game, you're told the meal's ready there. The children who'd come early, had been got up early, were ready for their meal and were ready to have a rest. The other children could play, provided they played quietly and didn't disturb the other children. And the ones that really didn't want to have a sleep could play quietly and not have a sleep. Some of the traditional carers in this place were terrified. They thought it would be mayhem and run amok. But it actually ran extremely well and the children became far more considerate of each other. But we're so used to doing things in pattern and to conform that our expectations of conformity are getting more and more. Obviously, we're worried if we don't see children, they get harmed. And you get the occasional appalling story of a child abducted by strangers and killed. But this continues to overlook the fact that 99 other children are abused in their family and not seen outside the family. And my feeling again is if we had communities that really kept an eye on all children in their communities, the occasional abduction would be harder to happen. I think repeatedly of little Bolton boy in England. To walk with a screaming, distressed toddler through a shopping centre without any adult saying what's going on here is a terrifying thing to think about, to have it as somebody else's business. So I think keeping an eye on children is everybody's business. And the older you get, the easier it is to say, what's going on here? Do you need some help? One of the most searing experiences I've had this year was from DCI going to the Inverbrakey Detention Centre before it was closed. As part of the inquiry into children in detention, I just had to interview some families. In fact, I had to interview about 10 families in one day through an interpreter, which was quite overwhelming about aspects of it, being there with their children. The hopelessness in that place continues to be a nightmare. These were very ordinary families, very ordinary families. Most had come down because the women were having a baby and they came down to have the baby. None of them knew where they were going. They were all terrified they were going to be sent to Manus Island or Nauru. And I think this has subsequently happened. The depression in these mothers was such, these were the mothers who subsequently were on suicide watch when they came back, because if they thought, then their reasoning had got to the point of thinking, well, if I try to commit suicide, maybe my baby will be safe. And I think we can't begin to think. Virtually most of the people I saw were Rohingyan from Burma. If they stayed in Burma, they risked being killed. They had no opportunity ever to work. They had no opportunity for healthcare, and their children had no opportunity for education. I wonder how I'd respond in a situation like that. It just worried me that, and I mean, Inverbrecky was the best detention centre. It was an old defence housing thing, very reasonable accommodation, a bit shabby, but okay. But you had no decision-making capacity whatsoever. There were enough houses for each family to have a house, but the decision was that families had to share houses, and you had no choice in who you shared with. You had a kitchen to cook your own food, and there was a small store where you could, for points, buy food. And that was infinitely better than most other places, but there was still this degree of control. The children could go to school part-time a few days a week. Their bags were checked every day when they came in, and they mostly had a body search. This is for a secure facility for low-risk people. There was a playground, but the children were not allowed into the playground again without parents, and if they were under 12 years of age, so the playgrounds were scarcely used. And it's this, and then the final straw for me was reading in the Canberra Times that these families were removed from this place at 3 a.m. And what is it like being woken in the middle of the night to be told you were leaving? And I'm sure they weren't told before, because already in this low-risk security place, these people had four checks a day, four counts to make sure they were there. And two of these were photo ones, which meant the guard had a list of the photos and would check their them with the photos. The last one of these was at night, so these sleeping children had a torch shone in their face to compare them with the photos. And this is our most humane facility in a humane country. And it's just not good enough for me. And then we spend so much time, at the rest of the time, worrying about abuse and children. So what are the benefits of noticing children? And the first thing is, to see a world afresh through a child's eye can be quite an arresting experience. I worked with a delightful principal, and he said that, you know, kids had come up to him and say, oh, sir, sir, can we do this, can we do this? And he said, your instinctive adult response is to say no. But then you think, well, why not? And again, when you think through some of these ideas, they're fantastic. This man also said to the teachers, if you haven't learned anything from the children in your class today, you haven't been listening. And the third thing was, if the children in your class are feeling secure and are well-fed, you can't stop them learning. And we don't have that sort of positive, enthusiastic working in with children to help encourage them to think more and more. And it, I think, does us a lot of good to rethink a lot of our entrenched ideas. Why have we always done it that way? Is there another way of doing it? Would the world fall apart if we did it differently? Is it worth at least trying something else out? And if you're doing nothing else with these children, we just think the children you treat in this way are going to be infinitely more sensitive, responsive carers for all of us in our old age than children have been told to do as they're told. I've spoken a little bit about the new and ongoing discoveries about babies' brains, but this all started about the time I was really getting in, I was immersed in my child abuse work. And I think several things worried me enormously. The first thing was, at the time, my children were quite small. I think I had children who were very dubious about staying with anyone else and were very much more happy being at home. I was seeing children 2, 3, 4, and 5 years of age who'd been abruptly removed from their homes because concerns for their safety, put in a car by strange people, brought to see me, another strange person, in a strange building, and persuaded to be stripped and examined.
and these children didn't protest. They didn't cry. They were not distressed. Some of them did their best to engage me by being particularly loving, coming and sitting on my lap, telling me they loved me, drawing love hearts. To me, terrifying behaviours. Most of the child protection workers with them would say, he's a good little kid, isn't he? Nobody was saying, why are children behaving in this outlandishly abnormal way? If somebody had tried to remove my children from me, take them off in a car, take them to a stranger, strip them and examine them, they would have had a huge job on their hands, or else the children would have been freaked out and absolutely despondent and despairing. I never see that response. So what are these children's lives like every day? That they have learnt to accommodate the totally unexpected, the totally unknown, and deal with it in a calm and accepting way. And I think this is one of the things that worries me most. So from thinking about this, we've actually learnt that from before they're born, babies are responding to influences from outside. Before birth, some of this is hormonal. So if you've got a stressed mother living in domestic violence, the hormonal responses to this baby's brain are already impairing the final development of the baby's brain. And obviously there are the direct insults from noise and blows. Once the baby is born, from the time they're born, I was tempted to put two more slides up there. I have some beautiful pictures. They took a video of babies at the time of birth looking at social interaction. And here was a one-hour-old baby boy born at term, quite a good delivery. Everything was going fine. He was handed to his dad to hold while they were tidying mum up. And somebody must have suggested to dad that he poked his tongue out. So you've got this picture of this dad looking at his new son, very proud of himself, proud of the baby. The dad pokes his tongue out at the baby. The baby, 4 seconds later, pokes his tongue out at the dad. The dad didn't quite believe it, did it again, and the baby responded faster. We now know these are very clever neurons that do this, called mirror neurons. But in terms of a totally helpless baby enlisting somebody to be there to care for them, what better thing could that baby have done? I mean, Dad went from saying, ah, my son, to, wow, he loves me, he's mine. He's, you know, the increased capacity then to keep that baby safe is huge. Yet we sort of somewhat ignore this. We sort of make bland comments like, it's good for bonding if you're there when the baby's born and all the rest of it. But it's within limits, and we're doing a lot of it now in a theoretical way rather than in a known intergenerational way. And we also know that from that very early age, if a baby is exposed to stress and distress and pain, it is permanently registered in their brain and affects their capacity to form lasting, trusting relationships. So how did I end up at this point in my life? I sometimes wonder. I was born in the middle of the war. This same uncle who had considerable skills with Aborigines was working in the Northern Territory with the Aboriginal contingent of the army who had to provide a lookout for the whole of the top end of Australia to let know of any possible arrival by Japanese boats. He knew how dangerous and perilous things were and kept saying to my mother, get out of Sydney. The obstetrician knew how dangerous and perilous things were and said, don't you dare move. It was probably just as well as she didn't, because she had a very complicated time and probably would have died if she was not in Sydney, and then my life would have been totally different. So from being born in Sydney, we moved up to the Blue Mountains, and I spent my untrammelled childhood running fairly wild in the Blue Mountains as we moved up between Springwood, Hazelbrook, Lawson, Lura and Katoomba. My mother was a teacher. She was a very good teacher. She was an absolutely committed teacher, actually. In fact, that was interesting in itself, because she also had had a tough time. Her father had died when she was one. Her mother had had an extraordinarily tough time. All of the effort was put, as it was in those days, into educating the brothers.
she had a very good job as a shorthand typist, and she was supposed to help support the brothers. And she came home and said, I'm going to be a teacher. And it was not very well thought of at the time, but she became a magnificent teacher. And then it was just as well, because my father was, although a delightful person in many ways, an absolutely disastrous husband and father and many other things. So my mother had to go back to work, and if she'd not been a teacher, again, our lives would have been very, very difficult. Anyway, she taught. We moved up the mountains as she taught in different schools. Along the line, I think I had my tonsils out or something and bled and had to have blood tests. I was about six and rounded on my mother and said, you never told me there were lady doctors. And she said, I didn't know that you wanted to know. I might say it was an absolutely driving ambition from then, but it was something that I knew could happen. I then got into medicine at Sydney University. But I really didn't think there were any other doctors other than GPs. Hello to my friend from Sydney University. That was interesting too. We lived in a small hostel. And so I developed a lot of counselling, management and other skills as one of the more senior people at the hostel over the years that were there, which have stood me in very good stead since. It was a very good community living experience. So anyway, I graduated. I went to St Vincent's Hospital. I've always thought I'd be a GP. In those days, you didn't have to be vocationally registered. But I thought, I was sensible enough to know all the things I didn't know, so I thought I'd better do some more obstetrics and paediatrics before I did that. So I did 6 months more obstetrics, which taught me a lot more things, and then I tried to do 6 months paediatrics. They said, we don't do that anymore, you have to do a year. So I did a year. And they said, when are you sitting for your specialist exams? I said, oh, I didn't think I would. Nonsense, said the professor. So 3 or 4 years later, I sat for the exams and passed them. But I still, other than being a paediatrician, hadn't thought what I'd do. He needed some paediatric gastroenterologists and suggested I did that. So I went to England to learn to be a paediatric gastroenterologist. And the first thing I learnt, I was doing a big study on children with celiac disease. And in the middle of this huge study in England were a number of really, really worrying families with children with what I now know to be factitious illness, with the parent, a very troubled parent, seeing the child as a sick child, treating the child as a sick child, and not wanting anything to change this. I can remember being stunned with one little girl saying to the mother with great delight, well, this is wonderful news. She's got all her enzymes. She doesn't have celiac disease. And the mother was so furious, she stormed out with the child. And I began to realise that being a parent and being a child was far more complex than I thought. Child abuse was not recognised as a medical issue at that time. It was just beginning to emerge that they were realising that children with bruises and broken bones might have been deliberately harmed. So I guess in many ways over the course of my career we have learnt a lot. Anyway, that turned me off from paediatric gastroenterology to becoming a community paediatrician and then specialising in this work. And again, there were two sentinel people in my doing this. The first one, even before I went to England to do my gastroenterology, was working with Dr. Alan Walker in the Northern Territory. And at that time, he was the only paediatrician for the top half of the Northern Territory. And when I went up as his junior registrar assistant, I was the second doctor for the paediatrician for the top half of the Northern Territory. It was the first time I had really worked with Aboriginal families living in their communities. It was the first time I'd worked in a remote part of the Northern Territory. And this was before Cyclone Tracy, not long before. And it made me realise there is just so much complexity in looking after children in community and looking after children's health in the community. And then I went to England and worked with another very impressive paediatrician, David Hull, who set up the paediatric school in Nottingham. And he was really interested again in community paediatrics. He felt that the hospital is the peak of the iceberg for a few sick children. Most of looking after children should happen with them in their homes. So I guess this is where it's come from. While I was over there, I met my husband. We stayed there for some years while he did his PhD in electronics in Nottingham when I did the work with David Hull. Then my mother became ill and she'd moved to Canberra by this time. So I came over here with two small boys while he finished his PhD and organised the house. He then came out and joined me here. We had my daughter as well. And, of course, we've been here ever since. It wasn't originally our intention, but once the children start school in a place that's rather hard to move and once they have all their friends. The ties with... My husband is Welsh. The ties with Wales remain, and my children, I think, feel they have two definite identities. It's very interesting having spent time in two very different communities, a small rural Welsh community where things only change about every 50 years, I think, but which has its pluses and its minuses. The stability is there, but the prejudices are huge. And then I come back to... So, well, I've come from Canberra over there from a very busy time and think, why can't Canberra be more like this? And then after a while, with the prejudices, the frustrations, I'd come back and I'd be pleased to come back here again. And as I said, my children have grown up here. 5 years ago, my husband died here very suddenly and unexpectedly, and that gave me my own personal learning about trauma. It also gave me my own personal learning about the critical importance of friends of every dimension, from family friends, work friends, community. I would not have continued without it, but it also means now that instead of a life of retirement with a husband doing goodness knows what we do, we were still debating that one. We had lots of debates because we had different priorities. In a way, it has freed me up to keep working. I enjoy my work immensely. I continue to learn. And apart from having three extremely bossy adult children who keep telling me that I need to think about what I'm doing and be more sensible, it generally is working quite well. It was a huge honour last year to be the Citizen of the Year. It was not only was it an honour, it was not a terribly onerous responsibility, but then that's been reversed this year by Katie Gallagher, who said, seeing I was Citizen of the Year last year, I could chair the community and expert reference group for the Asbestos Task Force this year, and that is not a sweet and social job. It is going to be a nightmare of a job because it is a nightmare of a problem. But the one thing, again, which is wonderful, is working with a very committed and dedicated group of people and doing a lot more learning. I think this is where my second slide comes in. Another one of Tex's beautiful artworks. This is probably my very favourite one. And it's called The Galah and the Boobunge. And it's a story of a young Aboriginal boy learning to throw the boomerang. And he was practicing and practicing. And one of the elders walked by, and the kid could not resist the opportunity to show off. But things went terribly wrong, and the boomerang hit the old man on the head, knocked out a bit of his hair, caused a bit of bleeding. The kid was appalled and frightened and ran off and hid under a prickle bush. The old man was furious and chased him and rolled him in the prickles. And the great creator looked down on all this and was most displeased, because the old man should have known that this boy was learning, he would make mistakes, and it was his job there to help him with his mistakes and help him with his learning. The boy should have known that the old man was the bearer of the knowledge, he was the teacher, he needed to treat him with respect, he needed to have been sorry. So the great creator dealt with his fury by turning the prickly little boy into a boobunge lizard, which has prickles on it, and turning the angry old man into a galah. And we know the story is true because if you look at a galah, it's got a bit of a bald spatch up the top there with some red at the bottom of it. And what both of these people needed to keep in mind all the time was mutual respect.
respect by the adult for the child because he was the learner and he was the one that was going to carry on the knowledge, and respect from the child to the adult because he had the knowledge and was teaching him. And I think this particular picture has helped me in my working life and probably my private life more than anything else, this whole idea of impossible situations with sometimes impossible people. If I walk down the hall towards the meeting saying mutual respect, mutual respect, mutual respect, you get a lot further. And I think it is something I'll be saying to myself quite a lot over the next time while I'm working with the asbestos group, working with wonderful people but with issues which are hugely challenging. So I think that's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sue. That was a fantastic talk. We've got time for just a couple of questions, if anybody would like to ask Sue anything. Thousands of questions. Yes, I've got thousands too.
Oh, I just wondered if you have a view on the current trend of a lot of parents to put a sheet or a blanket over a pram so a child has no interaction with the face that they see and they're shut off from a world, yeah, in a dark world.
This confuses me a lot. I think it's advice from one of the books on bringing up babies. I think it's, I personally think it's distressing. I can't think of anything better than to wake up in my pram and see my mum's face. Equally, I get concerned about all the easily collapsible pushchair things in which the child is heading headfirst into the world and nobody's paying attention. And again, that's a story that comes back to this very clever uncle of mine that makes you think way back when he was a baby, in the old and olden days, you had prams where the handle went either way. And I gather he demanded to be sat in the pram from the time he could scarcely sit so he could see his mum, and would be immensely distressed if he was put in the pram the other way so he couldn't. And I think, and again, I think that many babies, again, are not given the choice. It's just one of these things that happens. And it's, I think this happens with so many things. We just start a habit and you see other people doing it and you keep doing it too. But if you look at things from a baby's perspective, you often make a different decision.
I'm just wondering with your studies about personalities being formed from 0 to 7, whether with severely abused and neglected children you have often seen cases where they can reverse that and they, through counselling or group therapies, that they do end up being successful people?
Look, this is one of the things which I probably should have spoken on at great length, is my enormous respect for the children I work with and being quite astounded by what they achieve. And most of these kids come into adult life in an everyday sense being indistinguishable from other children. But the scars are there. I think their scars both for potential mental health problems in a very bad, in adverse circumstances. More than anything, their scars for low self-esteem. Their consequences, but it doesn't mean any of these things are hopeless. It still means you've got a fine person there who's been somewhat shaped by their experiences. I mean, some of these most abused little babies have ended up being individuals who still, as adults, in a stressful situation, will dissociate, absolutely blank off from the world around them, because that's how they survived as little people. So they survive as adults by dissociating, and many of them have trouble trusting other people in relationships. If you know you have a problem, you can seek help, and you can often do well. Some of the difficulties are recognising that you have a problem. It's the same with parenting. If you have been extraordinarily badly parented, it's going to be harder for you to parent. There are so many more things now we can do to help, but you have to recognise that you need help before we can help.
Well, thank you. Could everybody join me again in thanking Dr. Packer for the wonderful talk, and you can talk to her more down in the Friends Lounge if you'd like to join us for morning tea. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.